So here Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says, he says showing something, and we interpreted this in the political and social arena, that if you have a social or political idea and you show this, you know, roll out the red carpet before that political or social idea has become complete, before, you know, you have crossed all your T's and dotted all your I's, what is going to happen is that thing which we said political or social idea, that thing is going to spoil. It is going to be destroyed. It's going to be ruined. And it makes sense, right? If you have, and I mean, it applies to everything. You know, if you have an idea, if you have a certain thing that you want to do, if you have a game plan, right? Embarking upon implementing a game plan before that game plan is well thought out, of course, it will result in complete loss and, you know, destruction and spoiling and losing and that kind of things. And so a very, applicable and a very practical point that has been taught to us by the divinely appointed Imam, that listen, you know, think before you speak, and before you roll out something new, make sure that, you know, you have thought it through and you have checked as many variables as you possibly can, you know, and you have considered all the different aspects that play a role in this. Otherwise, if you don't do these things and you show something before it becomes complete, it will surely spoil that thing. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And in fact, in another tradition, in Al-Kafi, the uncle of Imam Ridha narrates that Imam began to cry for Bakka al-Ridha. That he began to cry when his uncles, in seeing their short-sightedness, how ignorant they are, how they may have never learned anything at all from their grandfathers, from their ajdads. And then he says, oh my uncle, have you heard the hadith of my father who narrates from the Messenger of Allah? This is Imam Ridha saying, بِأَبِّ إِبْنَ خِيرَةِ الْإِمَّاءَ النَّوْبِيَّةَ طَيِّبَةَ يَكُونُ مِنْ وُلْدِهِ الطَّرِيدَ الشَّرِيدَ الْمَوْتُورِ بِأَبِيهِ وَجَدِّهِ. That basically he goes on to say that the Messenger of Allah said that my progeny shall come from a purified, pure Nubian woman. That this pure Nubian woman shall become the source of many ma'asumeen, including the Imam of our time, because he was his grandmother, of course. This is a hadith of the Messenger of Allah about the Nubian woman, or this woman from this part of the world.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes, we feel. And we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won another term, garnering 52.16% of the vote. Right after the announcement of the runoff results Sunday night, opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu thanked the 25 million Turkish citizens who voted for him, especially youth and women, and promised to continue the struggle for democracy with his alliance.
The means of the state has been entirely pledged to one person. I could never stay silent when your rights were violated. I could never tolerate you becoming second-class citizens after millions of refugees came here. I fought for all this and I will continue to fight.
For her part, Good Party leader Meral Akşener congratulated President Erdogan on winning a new term and called her supporters and those who cast their vote in favor of the opposition candidate not to feel pessimism or loss, assuring that election is the most fundamental display of democracy.
Don't forget that we are still here at the parliament. We will continue to fulfill our responsibility. I want to congratulate Mr. Erdogan for being elected, but he should not forget that the polls conveyed messages to him as well.
Akşener delivered her speech from the Good Party headquarters in Ankara, rather than the area opposition alliance designated to celebrate their victory in the case of winning. Analysts believe the only reason those six political parties agreed to nominate one candidate despite their ideological differences is to gather their efforts and oust Erdogan. And with that not achieved, the nation alliance is likely to be divided.
I think in the coming few days, we may see divisions and resignations in the Turkish opposition, especially that the table of six gathered to unseat President Erdogan. On the other hand, I think the People Alliance and ruling AK Party will be facing a lot of challenges because Turkey is already struggling with economic crisis, the refugee crisis and some problems with the neighboring countries. The People Alliance must work harder now that they will govern the country.
More than 25 million Turkish citizens voted for opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. This election had been seen as Erdogan's biggest challenge, for the Nation Alliance was very close to unseating him. Now that the presidential run is over, political parties have already started preparing for the upcoming local election in 2024, with Erdogan promising his supporters a win in both opposition strongholds, the capital Ankara and the economic hub, Istanbul. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards non-violent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the yellow vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 yellow vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading, and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilize some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is, and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development, in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength, the policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race. North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed, and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Ishkuntana and his six-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. but my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration, from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that has been ignored. I mean, it's been ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and he's still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopen to the public soon.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Najat. Please stay tuned. In Ayah 37 of Surah Al-Isra, we read, "Do not walk exultantly on earth." In a narration, we read, "When a boastful person walks on earth, the earth will tell him or her not to walk exultantly, since one day you will be put under the ground in the grave and you won't be able to escape the pressure of earth. You are happy and you commit sins, but you will be sad and chastise for your deeds one day." Once the late Ayatollah Kompani, one of the teachers of the late Ayatollah Bahjat, went to buy some groceries in the city of Najaf. He took the fruits and vegetables and put them in his cloak to take them to his house. On his way back to the house, the groceries dropped off his cloak on the ground. He sat down and gathered them again in his cloak without any shame that he is a marja or the famous scholar of his time. He never wanted to act exultantly on the earth. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Najat. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Widespread loneliness in the U.S. poses health risks as deadly as smoking up to 15 cigarettes daily, costing the health industry billions of dollars annually, the U.S. Surgeon General said recently in declaring the latest public health epidemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Los Angeles Times, isolation and loneliness are an epidemic as damaging to Americans' individual and public health as smoking and obesity, the Surgeon General of the United States said in a stark advisory issued recently. Nearly half of the U.S. adults reported experiencing loneliness in recent years, according to research cited in the advisory. A 2021 study commissioned by the Cigna Healthcare Company showed 79% of people ages 18 to 24 reported feeling lonely, a rate nearly twice as high as that of seniors ages 66 and older. Though the issue was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, it has long been mounting. The rate of loneliness among young adults increased every year from 1976 to 2019. Surgeon General Vivek H. Murthy pointed out, being socially disconnected can have both mental and physical consequences. It puts people at greater risk for anxiety and depression and also increases the possibility of dementia by 50%, stroke by 32%, and heart disease by 29%. The risk of premature death from heightened isolation is comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day and maybe even greater than that associated with obesity and physical inactivity, according to the report. Still, studies show that 20% of people who feel lonely or isolated do not recognize it as a major problem. According to the advisory, Murthy laid out a national strategy to combat what he called profound threats to our health and well-being, saying the U.S. needs to address the epidemic with the same energy and intention it does the opioid addiction crisis or tobacco use. If we fail to do so, we will pay an ever-increasing price in the form of our individual and collective health and well-being, Murthy said, adding, and we will continue to splinter and divide until we can no longer stand as a community or a country. The report described social isolation as objectively having few social connections or interactions, while loneliness is a subjective and internal feeling resulting from a gap between the actual connections people experience versus the desired connections they yearn for. Research shows people are spending less time with friends and family or participating in organizations driven in part by technology winding its way into our social interactions. Some people move away from their communities, many others focus on their careers at the expense of their personal relationships. A study cited in the advisory showed that between 2003 and 2020, time spent with friends decreased by 20 hours per month, while time spent alone increased by about 24 hours per month. And that rise in isolation may be eroding Americans' trust for one another. Polls conducted in 1972 showed 45% of Americans felt they could reliably trust other Americans. That number shrank to roughly 30% in 2016, the advisory noted. It's a trend that goes against human nature and is producing adverse effects on individual and societal health, said Julian Holt Lundstedt, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Birmingham University and the advisory's lead science editor. Holt Lundstedt said humans are a social species. Throughout human history, we've needed to rely on others for survival. So it makes sense that our bodies are adapted to promote survival. Because of the way humans evolved and adapted, feeling disconnected, particularly from those we trust, becomes a very threatening state, Holt Lundstedt said, adding, it takes more energy and our bodies respond accordingly. Isolation causes our brains to become more active and signal various physiological responses that essentially throw our bodies out of rhythm, scientists said. One example is inflammation. Evidence shows that being isolated and lonely is associated with chronic inflammation, which increases risk of cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, depression, and Alzheimer's disease. Holt Lundstedt said there are many cascading biological responses that are occurring, that when these physiological changes are dysregulated on a chronic basis, this can increase risk for developing a variety of chronic illnesses. It can also affect community outcomes ranging from population health to community safety, civic engagement, and prosperity. This is both an individual as well as a societal level health concern. The pandemic compounded the decline of social connections as well as isolation and loneliness by cutting people off from their support networks. But it also gave people a sense of how essential connection is, Holt Lundstedt said, as they saw how less time with friends or family harmed their well-being and that of those around them. The Surgeon General Advisory, 82 pages long, issues a public call to action to foster greater social connection and provides a national plan to achieve it. Its six pillars include strengthening social infrastructure in local communities and mobilizing the health sector, offering recommendations that government agencies, workplaces, and others can take to bring people together in meaningful ways. In an essay published in New York Times days before the recent report, Morty described his own struggles with loneliness and underscored the risks facing America. Morty wrote, "Addressing the crisis of loneliness and isolation is one of our generation's greatest challenges. By building more connected lives and more connected communities, we can strengthen the foundation of our individual and collective well-being, and we can be better poised to respond to the threats we are facing as a nation." Meanwhile, RT noted loneliness can lead to chronic stress conditions, experts say, which can be a cause of additional maladies. A study appearing in the National Library of Medicine even suggested that the risk of premature death linked to social isolation is similar to smoking 15 cigarettes per day. The advisory cites polling information from 1970s, which said that 45% of Americans felt they could trust people in their circles. That figure plummeted to around 30% in similar polling conducted in 2016. It also stated that the amount of time Americans spent alone rose by an average of 24 hours per month between 2003 and 2020. The advent of social media and other online services such as food delivery networks has also reduced people's interactions and needs to leave their homes, the advisory says. These institutions and such situations were magnified even further by enforced isolation brought about by lockdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic, which Morty said via the Washington Post recently poured fuel on a fire that was already burning. He said, "I want the country to understand how profound a public health threat loneliness and isolation cause in the United States." The advisory document also calls for efforts to be made to mend the social fabric to U.S., which includes factors like teaching children how to pursue healthy relationships and for people to spend less time on social media.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, Al Muallim. This program is about the life and the works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and ulama all across the world during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Fadai, salam alaikum, welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, salam alaikum to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding maraj and fuqaha of the 13th and the 14th century Hijra, and one of the special students of Akhund al-Khurasani, who reached the status of marja'iyya and the general custodianship of the Islamic houses of Najaf in Iraq, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani, one of the most outstanding and exceptional characters of contemporary houses in Iran and Iraq. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some information about the early life of Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatullah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani was born in 1284 Hijri Qamari. He lived in Isfahan and Najaf al-Ashraf, in these two main Shiite cities at that time. And of course, he was buried in the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wassalam and died in 1365. Among his scholars, we can mention some of the great names like Mirza Habibullah Rashti, Akhund Khorasani, and Mirza Muhammad Hassani Shirazi. Each one of them is one of the great scholars of Tashayyu in the 14th century. And among the students of this great scholar, again, there are very great names. Among them is Sayyid Mohsen Hakim,
yes,
Muhammad Kuhistani Mazandarani, and Sayyid, yes, Muhammad Hadi Milani, which is really, and also Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. You see that all of them are We can say the greatest among the greatest scholars of the Shayu. Of course, among his works, we can mention some of the names and the titles of his books, like Wasilatul Najat, and which is a kind of commentary on Urwatul Wuthqa. And also he has a commentary on Tafsiratul Muta'allimin. He was, of course, a marja'i taqlid in his time. And in his, let's say, socio-political aspect of his life, you can mention that, yeah, he supported the constitutionalism in Iran.
Yes.
And, of course, he supported this kind of political movement.
That's right.
And kind of reforms in the political areas in Iran and also in Iraq. He was also opposed and against the invasion of Iraq at that time, which could be mentioned as some of his main political activities in his life.
That's all right. Especially the book Wasilatul Najat was very much considered by the following generations. For example, the late Imam Khomeini, they say that his book Tahrirul Wasila is based on Wasilatul Najat. So let's be a little bit concerned about his life as a marja, different experiences, I mean, religiously speaking and scholarly speaking, that he passed in order to reach the status of marja'iyya in Iraq.
You know, he, first of all, he lived in Iran, in Isfahan. And because at that time, the Hawza, the main center of Hawza, was in Najaf. But at that time, people who started to study in Hawza, if they want to grow to the highest level of Hawza, they had to migrate to Iraq and go to Najaf. So like other great scholars of Islam and Shia, after passing some grades in Iran, elementary levels of Hawza, he decided to migrate to Najaf. At the beginning, his father disagreed that, and the father doesn't like his son to leave the country, leave the city and go there, because maybe he knew that if he go to other country, he won't get back. And he didn't want that. He tried a lot to convince his father, and he started this journey. The journey was so hard, and even he had to walk a lot of ways and roads of the journey. But anyway, he could reach to the city of Najaf and continue his study. That's a great lesson for our generation, for youth. Although we have a lot of technologies, convenience nowadays, maybe some youth don't want to continue their study and grow in the levels of science. Always we think about entertainment, about having an easy life, which is not the duty of humans. If we want to have a good social life, we have to try, we have to do our best in order to grow in our knowledge. Not just person, even a country, a government, if it wants to grow, it has to grow and improve in knowledge. So we can get this lesson from our scholars. You know, leaving your country is not easy. Leaving your family and as you know, journey at that time was not easy. It was not any flight. It was not cars. You had to go with the camels or maybe sometimes like him on foot.
Yes.
So it is so hard. He did that. Mm-hmm. And you can see the conclusion. He could be one of the greatest scholars. And not just in Hawza, even in socio-political actions, he could be a leader like, I don't know, supporting the revolution, Thawra al-Ashreen.
Yes, yes.
And he supported that, and he gave a fatwa in order to support that, in order to save Islam and save Islamic countries, in order to oppose the colonialism.
Yes.
So that is the result of that hardship.
Mm-hmm.
If he didn't do that, he couldn't be a leader in knowledge, in politics, and as well.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, let's get now to his main
outstanding work, magnum opus, we say in English, we can't say Vasilatun Najat. What is this book exactly? We said that so many commentaries have been written on this book, especially Tahrir Wasila by the late Imam Khomeini. Let's be a little bit concerned with Vasilatun Najat.
Yes, Vasilatun Najat, as it is known as from its name, its title is very nice, Vasilatun Najat. You know, in
the
Islamic,
means for salvation.
Yeah, salvation,
huh?
Yeah. Yes, yes. To achieve a kind of prosperous life or to save yourself against hellfire.
Yes.
So there is a wasila, there is a mean by which you can save yourself. So that is why wasila to najat means that if you follow, if you observe the jurisprudential rulings in your life, it helps you to save yourself from the hellfire. So that's why the title is really nice, really beautiful, that is chosen by Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. But the other important point is that, of course, after Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, the other great Shia scholars tried to make use of this method.
Yes.
And actually their risala, their jurisprudential works were a kind of commentary which were related to this work of Allama Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. We can mention the name
so
of...
So we can say that most of the Risala or Tawzih al-Masail of the modern generation of the ulama are based on Tahrir
al-Wasila. Are based on this, and this wasila to najat, like Tahrir al-Wasila of Imam al-Khumayni, rahmatullahi alayhi, was also based on this wasila to najat of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. And of course, it becomes like a kind of original source for Risala or for jurisprudential works of the Shiite scholars after Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani.
They call it ta'liqa, isn't it?
Exactly,
It's a kind of commentary, I think.
Yes, it's commentary.
Or marginal writings, that's right.
Exactly.
Okay, that's all right.
One of the important points in his life, Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani's life, was to he supported other Islamic scholars, and it was a method of life among our scholars. They didn't used to live alone for themselves and not to care about other Islamic scholars. At that time, at his time, their Abbas regime of Iraq, they sent one of the scholars, Ayatollah Khalisi, to exile. They sent him to Saudi Arabia at that time in order not to be in power in Iraq. And then Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, in order to oppose this action, he migrated again to Iran. So it was not good for the regime because it could make people to go toward a revolution. And after a while, the regime decided to make Ayatollah Khalisi back, to bring him back. Of course, they sent Ayatollah Khalisi to Iran. But anyway, it was a defeat for that regime. After Ayatollah Khalisi came back to Iran, again, Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani went to Iraq and Najaf. That is the power that our scholar had all the time. You know, if you are really a scientist in Islam, and if you care about people's life, people will support you, and you can be in the center of power. And you should use your power in the way of haq, not for yourself. And again, another point in his life that we can focus on that is the ambassador of Britain at that time, they gave some money by check to him. And maybe they thought that by giving this money, we can overcome the Marjaiya of Shia. So we can colonize Marjaiya as we colonize the countries. But he kept that money and used it for people. The people who were damaged in the war and the attacks of Britain. And and when the ambassador understood that the money was not used for himself, the money was used for people, the ambassador said, we wanted to defeat him, but he did it for us. Now he is in power more than us because people know that he supports him. And of course, he added some money to that check. So this is our scholar. They don't gather money for themselves. They try to gather money, but it is managing money,
not
gathering money for ourselves. So they manage the money to use it for people, to their convenience.
Especially the students or tullab of the Islamic seminaries, you know, Sayyid Abdullah Sanad Isfahani was really after their, we can say, that's right, needs, financial needs. They say that the letters that were sent to him was read out by Sayyid Abul Hassan and they were torn away. So maybe not, for example, not a disgrace or we can say a trace of disgrace for over there. One outstanding and shocking story about his life is that a person killed his son. And he forgives the murderer of his son. You know, this is really a big lesson for some of us. That's right. A person gets to the Holy Shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam after Namaz al-Salat al-Jama'ah. He kills the son of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Aswani. But after some days, we can say he could do qisas or something like that, but he forgives the killer of his son.
Although he was in charge of Huza.
He could do anything. Yeah, yeah. He got the power.
He didn't have to forgive.
Yes, yes. He was in power. Ayatollah Behjat, in a handwritten letter, has narrated the latest Fahani, his fatwa against tatbir.
Yeah.
I mean, beating oneself and struggling, with a dagger or something for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And these were all the socio-political and the religio-cultural struggles of the late Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani.
Even because of his fatwa against tatbir, some of his mughalids, they rejected his position of marja'iyah and they stopped to follow him. Mm-hmm. You know, this is ignorance. What we call it, jahiliyyah.
Yes,
you follow someone and a scholar as your marja, and because you don't like his fatwa, you change your taglid.
That's right. Okay, thank you much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani. Zilhijjah 9, 1365, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away. His body was taken from Al-Kazamiyyah to the holy city of Najaf and was buried in one of the chambers around the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So many people attended the burial session and the ceremony of the late Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, up to an extent that they say that this presence overwhelmed the Democrat activities in Azerbaijan, in Iran. So it somehow it overshadowed, we could say, or as an umbrella term, that activities over there. And this is the life of the great men of Allah. You know, both their birth and death are a blessing for the Muslim lands. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher and the Life of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, the author of Vasilatul Najat. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.